This is Lecture 5 of the series Inflation and Price Controls.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. At the end of last week's lecture, I showed how the prices of products in a free market tend to be governed by their costs of production. I also showed how costs of production are themselves determined by prices of goods and services in limited supply, that is, by wage rates and by the prices of various physical commodities in limited supply, such as copper, raw rubber, and scrap iron. Tonight, I have two basic objectives. First, to show how the prices of goods and services in limited supply are determined in a free market. And second, to show what is the significance of such prices, that is, what they accomplish in the process of production and distribution in a free market. In explaining these prices and their significance, we will, of course, be completing our explanation of prices determined by costs of production. Because as we have seen, prices determined by costs of production are ultimately determined by prices of goods and services in limited supply. But we will be doing more. We will be explaining all remaining prices in the economic system as well. Let us begin by considering a kind of catalog of goods and services in limited supply, so that we will see more concretely to what the principles we develop will apply. The most important item in this list, of course, is human labor. Human labor is always limited by the number of people able to work. In addition, the labor of each human being is limited by his need for rest and relaxation. And as the general level of real wages, that is, the quantity of goods a worker can buy with his money wages, goes up, the fewer are the hours that people are prepared to work. Because to the degree that they can earn a higher standard of living from any given number of hours of labor, their need for the additional real income that extra hours could provide is less. In addition to this, the supply of professional level labor, of course, is always still further limited, as is that of skilled labor. After labor services come materials whose supply is temporarily limited, such as agricultural commodities between harvests. Housing and buildings of all kinds are in a state of temporarily limited supply because considerable time is always required before their supply can be increased through new construction. Any material, any good whatever, is capable of being in limited supply temporarily if the demand for it outruns the ability to supply it from existing inventories and existing plant and equipment at a price based on cost of production. Land sites are in the category of goods in limited supply insofar as there is anything special about them that makes them superior to presently unused land, such as their superior location or superior fertility. In a few cases, the products of such land sites are in the category of goods in limited supply, not only on a temporary basis, but on a more or less permanent basis. For example, wines of a special flavor that can be produced only from grapes grown on a soil of a very limited extent, or caviar found in sturgeon beds located in only a few places. Finally, such goods as paintings and statues by old masters, first editions, rare coins, and so on, are in the category of goods in limited supply on a permanent basis, because their production is necessarily past. Now, the prices of all goods and services in limited supply are determined in an essentially similar way in a free market and have a similar significance. But some cases present far less complication than others. What I will do, therefore, is this. First, I will present two basic elements determining the prices of all goods and services in limited supply. Then, because of their greater simplicity, I will examine the significance of the prices specifically of consumers' goods in limited supply, such as the rare wines I mentioned, or rental housing. After I have done this, I will proceed to examine the significance of prices in the more complex case of factors of production in limited supply. Factors of production, incidentally, are simply labor services, materials, machines, and anything else that is bought for business purposes. That is, for the purpose of earning profits through subsequent sales. The prices of factors of production determine the costs of production. Let us look now at the determinants of all prices of goods and services in limited supply, whether consumers' goods in limited supply or factors of production in limited supply. One basic determinant is the quantity of money in the economic system. As we saw in earlier lectures, the quantity of money determines demand. In those lectures, of course, we considered the quantity of money merely as a determinant of aggregate demand. However, aggregate demand is nothing but the sum of the demands for each individual good. The quantity of money determines aggregate demand only in determining the demand for individual goods. Now, we will not go too far wrong if we assume that once an economic system becomes adjusted to a change in the quantity of money, its effect is pretty much to change the demand for everything more or less to the same degree. This means, for example, that in the long run, if the quantity of money doubles and everything else remains the same, including such things as the rate at which the money supply increases and is expected to increase, the demand for each individual good and service in the economic system should also tend to double. That is, with a doubled quantity of money, we should expect that eventually the demand for shoes, baseballs, zinc, skilled labor, what have you, should all just about double. And this means that in the long run at least, we can regard the money supply as acting more or less equally on the price of everything. Let us put the quantity of money aside now and turn to the second major determinant of prices. And that is the value judgments of the consumers with respect to the various goods and services on which they spend the quantity of money. The value judgments of the consumers with respect to the various goods and services on which they spend the quantity of money. The value judgments of the consumers determine, in essence, how the total aggregate demand that is made possible by any given quantity of money is distributed among the products of the various industries and among all the different goods and services in limited supply. The value judgments of the consumers determine, for example, how much is spent for shoes versus shirts, and indirectly, therefore, how much is spent for leather versus cloth, cowhides versus cotton, and grazing land versus cotton land. Similarly, for the labor services at each stage. In determining the spending for all the different consumers' goods, each with its own requirements for labor of specific types, the consumers determine how much is spent in the economy as a whole for each type of labor in relation to every other type of labor, both in terms of specific occupations and in terms of wide groups of occupations, such as skilled labor versus unskilled labor. Similarly, for all other goods and services in limited supply, such as diamonds versus wheat, real estate in New York City versus real estate in Des Moines, Iowa, and so on. In this way, the value judgments of the consumers ultimately determine the prices of all goods and services in limited supply in relation to one another. To sum up these points, one could say that the quantity of money determines the absolute height of all prices, and that the value judgments of the consumers determine their relative heights. Please note that it follows from the preceding discussion that it is the value judgments of the consumers that ultimately determine the relationships among the wages of the various ability groups. It is their pattern of buying that determines how much more professional labor must be paid than skilled labor, and how much more skilled labor must be paid than unskilled labor, and so on. Now let us begin to consider the significance of the prices of goods and services in limited supply. As I said, we will begin with the comparatively simple case of consumers' goods in limited supply. But our conclusions will be applicable to all goods and services in limited supply, factors of production as well as consumer goods. For our purposes, the most important characteristic of the price of a good in limited supply, and the one which most needs to be stressed, is this, namely, the fact that in a free market, the price of a good in limited supply always tends to be set high enough to level the quantity of the good demanded down to equality with the limited supply of it that exists. I will repeat this. In a free market, the price of a good in limited supply always tends to be set high enough to level the quantity of it demanded down to equality with the limited supply of it that exists. By the expression quantity demanded, incidentally, I mean merely the quantity of the goods the buyers are seeking to buy. The quantity of the good the buyers are seeking to buy. As an illustration of this principle, consider the case of a rare wine. It may be that potentially millions of people would enjoy drinking this wine and would be prepared to buy tens of millions of bottles of it every year. But because of the limitation of the special soil on which the necessary grapes can be grown, no more than, say, 10,000 bottles of the wine can be produced in an average year. What happens in this case is that the price of the wine rises to such a point that the great majority of potential buyers are simply eliminated from the market. They look at the high price and say to themselves, "This wine is simply too expensive for me, however delicious it may taste." In fact, in the knowledge that this would be their decision, the very existence of such a wine would probably never even be called to the attention of the great majority of people. As for those who do buy the wine, the high price probably makes almost all of them restrict the amount of it that they consume. At $50 a bottle, say, even millionaire wine lovers probably drink it much less often than they would at, say, $10 a bottle. The case of apartment rentals is essentially the same. In a free market, rents go high enough to level down the quantity of rental space demanded to, or somewhat below, equality with the limited supply of it that exists. The only difference is that in an economy like that of the United States, no one need be excluded from the rental market entirely. Everyone is always able to afford to rent some space, even if it is only half of a room he must share with someone else. Always, a free market price acts to level the quantity demanded of any good or service in limited supply down to equality with the limited supply of it that exists. This characteristic of a free market price has a major implication. It implies that shortages cannot exist in a free market, even in cases of the most severely limited supply. That is because, however limited the supply may be, a free market price always rises high enough to level down the quantity demanded to equality with the supply available. In a free market, limited supplies do not cause shortages, but high prices. At the high price, there is no shortage. In order to further prove this point, let us take an extreme example, one that is very unfair to the free market, namely the case of the gasoline shortage of 1973-74. In a variety of ways, many of which I have not yet mentioned, the government was responsible for vastly reduced supplies of gasoline, especially, as we saw, in the Northeast. Let us start with these artificially low supplies of gasoline and imagine that at that point, the government had simply repealed its price controls on gasoline. Think back now to the sight of service stations with multi-block long lines of cars waiting for gasoline. Let us imagine a service station that has 1,000 gallons of gasoline in its own tanks and is confronted with a line of cars seeking 2,000 gallons of gasoline for their tanks. This is a case of 1,000 gallons of gasoline available, 2,000 gallons demanded. Observe, even in this case, a free market would have equalized the quantity demanded with the supply available. If the owner of the gas station had been free to set his own price, he would have set a price high enough to make cars with a demand for 1,000 gallons of gasoline drive off the line. Such a price undoubtedly existed. If you don't believe it, imagine the gas station owner simply auctioning his gasoline off to the highest bidders. As the price at the auction rose, more and more bidders would have restricted the quantities they bid for, and some would have dropped out of the bidding altogether. At some point, the quantity of gasoline demanded would have been cut back to equality with 1,000 gallons available. It makes no difference, of course, if instead of conducting an auction, the service station owner had simply set his price where such an auction would have set it. In either case, people who previously were prepared to buy 2,000 gallons of gasoline would have found that they could not afford more than 1,000 gallons and would have limited their purchases accordingly. In fact, things would have gone further than this. A service station owner, not restricted by price controls, would have considered the demand not only of the cars presently in line, but of all the cars that might have shown up later in the day, or the next day, or any time before his next deliveries were to arrive. He would not have been willing to sell gasoline to someone presently in line if he expected that someone else would show up later willing to pay more. The price he set, in other words, would have corresponded to the price set in an auction market that extended over time and represented future bidders as well as present bidders. The effect of the owner's pricing gasoline in this way would have been not only to further reduce the quantity demanded on the part of those presently in line, thereby reducing the waiting line further, but actually to make gasoline available at all times at his service station. Since all other service station owners would also have been pricing gasoline in the same way, motorists would soon have realized that gasoline was in fact available whenever they wished it and in whatever quantity they wished it, provided they were willing to pay the price. There would have been no shortage, and motorists would have known that they did not have to fear a shortage. They would have ceased to be afraid to drive with less than a full tank of gasoline. This would have totally eliminated the lines. I must note that this whole discussion is, of course, largely a description of what has actually happened. Shortages have ended because the controls on oil prices have been substantially relaxed since the period of the crisis and totally eliminated as far as imported oil goes. Of course, in the case of a good like gasoline, a rise in price not only restricts the quantity demanded, but also pulls in supplies from other markets and supplies held by distributors for future use. As we will see, it also causes oil refineries to step up the production of gasoline at the expense of other petroleum products, if necessary, and in the long run, it increases the total production of oil products. In these ways, a free market not only balances the demand and supply of gasoline, but does so at the point of large and continuously growing supplies. However, the crucial point here is that even in the case of goods in strictly limited supply, there are no shortages, no waiting lines in a free market. Whoever has the price is always able to buy as and when he wishes and as much as he wishes. Now, there is a further very important point that follows from our discussion, and that is that in the context of limited supplies, it is not only to the self-interests of the sellers that prices rise when conditions make it necessary, but no less to the self-interests of the buyers. It is simply not true, as most people seem to believe, that the interests of buyers are always served by low prices. On the contrary, it is to the self-interest of buyers of goods in limited supply that prices be high enough to exclude their competitors from the market. To grasp this point in the clearest possible way, imagine an art auction with two bidders for the same painting. One of them is willing to go as high as $1,000, the other as high as $2,000. The man whose limit is $2,000 would certainly like to pay as little as necessary. He would be glad to pay just $100, or less if he could. But given the fact that someone else at the auction is prepared to bid up to $1,000, it would be very foolish for this man to insist on paying any preconceived figure below $1,000. If he arbitrarily insisted on bidding any amount below $1,000, the effect of his action would simply be to allow the painting to go to his rival. If he bid exactly $1,000 and refused to bid any more, he would make it a matter of accident to whom the painting went. If the other bidder bid the $1,000 first, it would probably go to that other bidder. In either case, by refusing to outbid the other bidder, he would prevent himself from getting the painting he wants, and which he really values above the other bidder's maximum of $1,000. It is, therefore, to the self-interest of this man to bid above $1,000 for the painting. Now, there is absolutely no difference, as far as this man is concerned, if instead of his having to appear personally at an auction and outbid his rivals, the art dealer who possesses the painting anticipates the strength of his bid and simply sets a price on the painting in his gallery that is high enough to deter other potential buyers and thus to reserve it for him. From the standpoint of the rightly understood self-interests of this man, it is a positively good thing that the art dealer asks more than $1,000. Because if he did not, someone else would buy the painting and it would be gone by the time our man got around to trying to buy it. The only difference between the cases of the art auction and the art dealer and that of all other commodities in limited supply is simply one of size. Instead of it being a unique painting that is put up for auction or for sale, and which is of interest to a relatively small number of bidders or potential buyers, it is more common to have millions of units of the same good offered in the market and sought after by large numbers of bidders or potential buyers. Just as in the case of the painting, in all these cases too, the fact that a price is high enough to level the quantity of the good demanded down to equality with the limited supply of it that exists is very much to the interest of all those buyers who are willing and able to pay that price. That price is their means of eliminating the competition for the good from other bidders or potential buyers not willing to pay as much. It is their means of being able to secure the good for themselves. In our example of the wine, for instance, the price of $50 a bottle, if that is the price necessary to level the quantity demanded down to equality with the supply available, is in the interest of everyone who values the wine above $50. Because if the price were any lower, the wine would be within reach of other potential buyers who did not value it so highly. And it would, therefore, to that extent, not be available to those who did. In the same way, whatever price of a square foot of rental space or any other good is required to level the quantity demanded down to equality with the supply available, that price is to the interest of all those who value that space or that good at any higher level. Because if the price were any lower, they would simply lose their ability to secure the good for themselves. The good would be bought up by those not able or willing to pay as much. And consequently, to that extent, it would be unavailable to those who did value it sufficiently. There are two possible misunderstandings of what I am saying that I want to anticipate and answer at this point before going any further. First, I want to stress that the ability to outbid others for the supply, or part of the supply of a good, is by no means the exclusive prerogative of the rich. The fact is that everyone exercises this prerogative to the extent that he earns an income or has any money to spend at all. Even the very poorest people outbid others, and the others whom they outbid can include people who are far wealthier than themselves. Of course, this is not true in a case such as our example of the rare wine, where the entire supply is obviously consumed by those who are quite well-to-do. But it is true in a case such as rental space, or housing in general, where everyone succeeds in obtaining some part of the supply. In a case of this kind, a wealthier family will obtain a larger share of the supply than a poorer family. But what stops it from obtaining a still larger share is the fact that the poorer family outbids it for part of the supply. For example, a wealthier family may rent an 8-room apartment, while a poorer family rents only a 4-room apartment. The reason that the wealthier family does not rent a 9-room apartment is the fact that the poorer family is able and willing to pay more for its 4th room than the wealthier family is able and willing to pay for its 9th room. This competition, of course, does not take place at an actual auction, but the result is exactly the same as if it did. If, for example, apartments are renting at some given figure per room, such as $75 a month, and the poorer family decides it can afford a four-room apartment, while the wealthier family decides it cannot afford a nine-room apartment, the implication is that the poorer family values a fourth room above $75, while the wealthier family values a ninth room below $75. In effect, the poorer family outbids the wealthier family for this extra room, or as economists often say, for this marginal room. If this poorer family wants to be sure of obtaining its four rooms, it is just as important to it that rents be high enough to level down the quantity of space demanded to equality with the supply available as it is to the richer family. If the price were any lower than the necessary equilibrium price, then while some poorer families might be able to afford a fifth room, wealthier families would just as often be able to afford a ninth room. And as often as poorer families succeeded in grabbing off a fifth room at the expense of a wealthier family's eighth room, a wealthier family would succeed in grabbing off a ninth room at the expense of a poorer family's fourth room. The same results apply to any good that is universally consumed. An artificially low price permits the rich to expand their consumption at the expense of the poor, just as often as it permits the poor to expand their consumption at the expense of the rich. Thus, the setting of prices at levels high enough to achieve equilibrium between the quantity demanded and the supply available is to the interest of everyone, irrespective of his income. I must point out that a harmony of interest exists in a free market, even in those cases in which some people are totally excluded from the market for particular goods. It exists on a remoter plane. For example, the present price of Rembrandt paintings excludes me from the market for those paintings, entirely and without question. Nevertheless, it is to my self-interest that if someone must be excluded, it be me and not an industrial tycoon. Because if his vastly greater economic contribution to production did not enable him to live at a better level than I do, I would be in trouble. To put this another way, if an industrial tycoon can have his art collection and other super luxuries, then I can have all the food I want, a house, an automobile, and so on, and more and better all the time. If I were to be able to compete on equal terms with him for the super luxuries, he would have no motive to conduct production in such a way that I am assured of all of the necessities and lesser luxuries. In order to avoid a second possible misunderstanding about the interest buyers have in prices being sufficiently high, I want to stress that I am not saying that people should simply welcome higher prices and be glad to pay them. Obviously, rising prices are currently imposing major hardships on large numbers of people, myself included, and they cannot simply look on stoically and be glad of their ability to pay those prices. However, there are two separate things here that we must very carefully distinguish, namely the fact of the rise in prices and the cause of the rise in prices. Our example of the art auction may serve to make this distinction clear. Assume that the losing bidder, whose maximum bid was previously $1,000, is now placed in a position in which he is able to bid as high as $1,500. In order to outbid him, our man will now have to bid above $1,500, whereas before he only had to bid above $1,000. Obviously, this is not a pleasant development for our man. But nevertheless, it is still to his interest to bid a price that is sufficiently high to secure him the painting. Our man should indeed still value the opportunity to outbid his rival. His sorrow should be directed only at that which now makes it more difficult for him to do so. In the same way, today, people should indeed still value the opportunity to outbid their rivals, and the fact that sellers set prices high enough to achieve this objective for them. Their wrath should be directed simply at that which makes it more and more difficult for them to accomplish this overbidding. What they should be angry about is not the existence of a market economy and the way the market economy works, but at the presence in the market of a vast gang of dishonest bidders and dishonest buyers, a gang that does its bidding and buying with newly created money, a gang that bids and spends dollars created out of thin air in competition with their earned dollars. The source of these dollars created out of thin air is, of course, the government itself, as we have seen. And the dishonest gang consists of the government and of everyone else who demands and receives such fiat money. In other words, it is inflation and the pressure group demands for inflation that the victims of rising prices should denounce, not the market economy or the opportunity it affords them for outbidding their rivals. It is the entry of newly created money into the economy that they should seek to stop, not the registry of that newly created money in the form of higher prices. Instead of, in effect, calling for the closing of the market, they should simply call for an end to the government's inflation of the money supply and for the establishment of a fully free market. Let us conclude our analysis of consumers' goods in limited supply and then begin to apply what we have learned to the case of factors of production in limited supply. My final point concerns the distribution of consumers' goods in limited supply. Distribution in the sense of who actually ends up with them. On the basis of the way their prices are determined, the distribution of consumers' goods in limited supply always tends to take place in a free market in accordance with two criteria. One, the relative wealth and income of the various potential buyers. And two, the relative intensity of their need or desire for the good in question. The wealthier a buyer is, the more of any good he can afford to buy, obviously. But wealth is not the sole criterion of distribution. Where two buyers possess the same wealth, the one who desires a good more intensely will be willing to devote a larger proportion of his wealth to its purchase, and he will therefore be able to outcompete an equally wealthy buyer who values the good less intensely. And of course, in many cases, a buyer who possesses a sufficiently strong desire will be able to outcompete a far wealthier buyer. In our example of the wine, for instance, a wine connoisseur of relatively modest means might very well be willing to pay prices that a millionaire would not. Or because of their relative preferences, some poorer families might outcompete some wealthier families, not just for a marginal room, but for an equal-sized apartment, by devoting a sufficient proportion of their income to rent. In a free market, therefore, consumers' goods in limited supply are distributed in accordance with purchasing power directed by desires, or equivalently, in accordance with desires backed by purchasing power. Everyone consumes these goods in accordance with a combination of his means and his desires. Now please hold in mind what we have learned about the prices of consumers' goods in limited supply. Namely, one, they balance the quantity of a good demanded with the supply of it available. Two, they are formed in accordance with the self-interests of the buyers as well as the sellers. And three, they make the physical distribution of a good take place in accordance with a combination of the wealth and incomes and needs and desires of its various consumers. all of this applies to factors of production in limited supply. That is, it applies to the prices of materials, labor, machinery, and anything else that is bought for business purposes and that is limited in supply. Observe, the price of a factor of production in limited supply is also determined in such a way that the quantity of it demanded is leveled down to equality with the limited supply of it that exists, just like a consumer's good in limited supply. What pushes the price to the necessary height is, once again, a combination of the self-interests of the sellers and the buyers. The immediate buyers directly concerned are, of course, businessmen. Businessmen desire a factor of production not for the satisfaction of their own personal needs or wants, but in order to secure the means of producing goods for profit. Nevertheless, it is just as much against the interests of businessmen to try to pay too little for a factor of production as it is for a consumer to try to pay too little for something he buys. Like a consumer, a businessman must be willing to pay prices that are high enough to secure him the things he wants. This means that he must be willing to pay prices that outbid what other businessmen are able to offer for the same part of the supply. In this connection, incidentally, I must point out that the doctrine that self-interest drives employers to arbitrarily pay subsistence wages is as absurd as the belief that self-interest drives the bidder at an art auction to offer scrap paper prices for a valuable painting. Employers who would arbitrarily decide to pay too low wages would simply enable other employers to hire away their labor. The employer who wants labor must be willing to pay wages that are high enough to make that labor too expensive for all its other potential employers. Now, the only complication that is introduced by the price of a factor of production in limited supply is that it does double duty, so to speak. It not only levels down the quantity of the factor that is demanded, but indirectly, the quantity of all the various products of the factor as well. Let us consider first a simple case, the case of a factor of production that has only one product, say cigarette tobacco. Its only product is cigarettes. The price of cigarette tobacco does double duty. It not only levels down the quantity of cigarette tobacco that is demanded, but as a major part of the costs of producing cigarettes, it carries through to the price of cigarettes and also levels down the quantity of cigarettes demanded. Observe, the price of cigarette tobacco equalizes both the quantity of cigarette tobacco and of cigarettes that is demanded with the supply of cigarette tobacco that is available. Observe how this happens. The price of cigarette tobacco is a cost of producing cigarettes, and therefore determines the price of cigarettes. As the price of cigarette tobacco rises, the cost of producing cigarettes and the price of cigarettes rise. As the price of cigarettes rises, the quantity of cigarettes demanded falls. In fact, it is this fall in the quantity demanded of cigarettes as their price rises, that necessitates a fall in the quantity demanded of cigarette tobacco as its price rises. As the price of cigarette tobacco rises, businessmen reduce the quantity of it they buy because they know that they cannot sell as many cigarettes at the higher prices that are necessary to cover the resulting higher cost of production. In this way, as I say, the price of cigarette tobacco levels down both the quantity of cigarettes as well as cigarette tobacco demanded to equality with the supply of cigarette tobacco available. Nothing is changed if we now consider the somewhat more complicated case of wheat, or any other factor of production that has a variety of products, such as skilled labor. As the price of wheat rises, the cost of production and prices of all products made from wheat, such as bread, crackers, macaroni, whiskey, and wheat-fed cattle and chickens, also rise. The rise in the prices of wheat products reduces the quantity of the various wheat products demanded, and this reduces the quantity demanded of wheat. Again, as the price of wheat rises, businessmen cut back their purchases in anticipation of the fact that they will not be able to sell as many wheat products at the higher selling prices necessary to cover the higher cost of wheat. In this way, therefore, through its effect on cost of production and the selling prices of all the various wheat products, the price of wheat equalizes not just the quantity of wheat demanded, but also the quantity demanded of all wheat products as a group, with the supply of wheat available. There is a further important similarity between what is accomplished by the price of a factor of production in limited supply and the price of a consumer's good in limited supply. And that is that if we look at the whole range of products of such a factor as forming a single group, we can observe the same essential principle of distribution with respect to the factor that we previously observed with respect to a consumer's good in limited supply. Namely, the factor itself, or at least the benefit of the factor, as represented by its various products, is distributed to the various individual consumers in accordance with their relative purchasing power and in accordance with their relative desire for products of that type. For example, the supply of wheat in the form of its various products is distributed to the ultimate consumers in accordance with a combination of their relative wealth and relative preferences for products made of wheat. Other things equal, richer buyers obtain more of the supply of wheat than poorer buyers. Not that richer buyers eat more bread, they probably eat less of it, but that they eat more meat, which requires far more wheat in its production, pound for pound, in the feeding of cattle, than does bread. In the same way, a buyer with a relatively stronger preference for wheat products, such as a buyer who especially likes steak and scotch, is able to obtain a larger share of the benefit of the wheat supply than a buyer of equal wealth who values these things less. Crude oil, skilled and unskilled labor, and all other factors of production in limited supply are distributed, if one may still use that word, to the consumers in just the same way, through their respective products. Thus far, we can see that the prices of factors of production in limited supply have the same characteristics and the same significance as the prices of consumers' goods in limited supply. The great difference between them concerns the fact that there is an added dimension of distribution in the case of the factors of production. A factor of production is not only distributed to different persons, but to different concrete uses or employments as well. It goes to the persons only in the form of those specific uses or employments. For example, consumers do not buy wheat or skilled labor as such, but the various specific products of wheat or skilled labor. The supply of the factor must be distributed among these various products in order to produce them. This distribution of a factor of production among its various products is the result of a further process of mutual bidding and competition among the consumers. Only this time, it is not merely one consumer bidding against another consumer, but the different needs, desires, or purposes of one and the same individual consumers bidding against each other as well. For instance, there is a competition for wheat between its use for baking bread, its use for making spaghetti, its use for making whiskey, feeding meat animals, and so on. There is a competition for crude oil between its use for making gasoline, its use for making heating oil, and so on. And there is a competition for labor of each ability group between all of its various possible employments. Since the same individual consumers consume most or all of the various products of these factors of production, the competition is, as I say, ultimately largely one between the competing needs, desires, or purposes of the same individuals. In order to grasp the nature and the importance of this competition, let us consider the question of why just so many bushels of wheat, to continue with that example, are devoted to baking bread, so many to making crackers, so many to making spaghetti, whiskey, feeding meat animals, and so on. Why aren't a million bushels, say, withdrawn from making crackers and added on to baking bread? The reason this does not occur is that the consumers of the quantity of crackers requiring the million bushels in question are perfectly willing and able to pay a price for the crackers that makes it profitable to cracker manufacturers to produce them at the current price of wheat. The consumers of the crackers, in other words, are willing to allow the producers of the crackers to pay the present price of wheat. But suppose that a million bushels of wheat were used to produce additional loaves of bread. In order to find customers for the additional bread, its price would have to be reduced. In fact, in a country like the United States, where even the very poorest person can already buy all the bread he desires, the price would probably have to be cut so drastically as to induce people to feed the extra bread to pigeons. Conceivably, the extra bread might not be saleable at any price. In any case, it is clear that the bakers of bread would not be able to buy any additional wheat except at a lower price of wheat. And that means that the bread industry, in effect, bids less for the million bushels of wheat in question than the cracker industry. The cracker industry gets the wheat by outbidding the bread industry. And this happens because, indirectly as it were, the consumers of crackers are outbidding the consumers of bread for that wheat. For the same reasons, the reverse situation does not occur either. That is, a million bushels of wheat are not withdrawn from the bread industry and added on to the cracker industry. Because the consumers of the present quantity of bread are willing to pay prices for that quantity that allow the bread industry to be profitable at the present price of wheat. In other words, they permit the bread industry to pay the present price of wheat. But the consumers of crackers would only be willing to buy a larger quantity of crackers at a lower price. In order for crackers to be profitable at a lower price, the price of wheat would have to be lower. As a result, the only way the cracker industry could buy an additional quantity of wheat would be at a lower price of wheat than the bread industry is willing to pay for it. Thus, the bread industry outbids the cracker industry for this particular quantity of wheat. Again, indirectly as it were, it is the consumers of the one product outbidding the consumers of the other product for the quantity of wheat in question. And since it is the same people who consume both bread and crackers, it is really one kind of need, desire, or purpose of the same individuals outcompeting another. In exactly the same way, any other such transfer of wheat from one use to another is prevented by the fact that in its changed employment, the quantity of wheat in question could only be employed profitably at a lower price than in its present employment. In other words, the present employments outbid the potential changed employments, and thus they get the wheat. And the reason they outbid them is because of the fact that the consumers are, as it were, willing to pay more for wheat in its present employments than in its potential changed employments. In this way, the distribution of wheat to its various uses is determined by a process of competition among those uses, which in turn represents a process of competition among the needs, desires, and purposes of one and the same individual consumers. For it is largely the same people who buy the various wheat products. We can substitute any factor of production for wheat, and the results will be the same. If we ask why 1 million man-hours of unskilled labor are not withdrawn from one industry and added on to another, the answer, again, is that the consumers are willing to pay product prices in its present employments that enable businessmen to employ that labor profitably at its going wage rate. If the labor were shifted, however, the consumers would only buy the resulting products at prices that would require lower wage rates for their production to be profitable. These products, therefore, are unable to compete for the necessary labor. They are unable because of the choices and value judgments of the consumers, which enable the existing employments to outbid them. Now, a principle which emerges from our discussion is that in a free market, a factor of production in limited supply always tends to be distributed to its most important employments, as determined by the value judgments of the consumers themselves. I will repeat this. In a free market, a factor of production in limited supply always tends to be distributed to its most important employments, as determined by the value judgments of the consumers themselves. In our example of the wheat, it was more important for 1 million bushels to be employed in producing crackers that people wanted, as demonstrated by their willingness to pay for them, than additional bread that people did not want or wanted less. It was more important for 1 million bushels to be retained in producing bread that was desired than to be added on to producing crackers that were less strongly desired, as manifested this time in the willingness of consumers to allow more for wheat used to produce bread than for wheat used to produce additional crackers. It is this way in every case. A factor of production in limited supply is employed in those uses that can afford to pay the highest prices for it. And that is determined by the willingness of the consumers to pay prices for the resulting final products. Every factor of production in limited supply is distributed to those employments where the consumers are willing to allow the most for it in the prices of the goods they buy. That is, it is distributed to those employments which the consumers regard as the most important to their own well-being. Now, I must point out that the concept, the most important employments of a factor of production, is a variable range that expands or contracts with the supply of the factor of production available. What it means is the most important employments for which the supply of the factor suffices. The most important employments for which the supply of the factor suffices. For example, if the supply of the factor is extremely limited, the most important employments for which the supply suffices might be as important as life itself. If the supply is very great, the most important employments can extend downward to include many luxury uses. The case of wheat again provides a good example. In a country like India or medieval France, devoting wheat to its most important employments means, essentially, producing as much bread as possible to ward off starvation. In a country like the present-day United States, devoting wheat to its most important employments ranges downward through totally satisfying the desire for products such as bread, heavily satisfying the desire for such things as cakes and cookies made from wheat, substantially satisfying the desire for alcoholic beverages made from wheat, and partly satisfying the desire for wheat-fed meat. Now, a second major principle follows from this discussion, and that is that the price of every factor of production in limited supply, and thus the prices of all of its products, is determined by the importance attached to the least important of the employments for which its supply suffices. That is, by the importance attached to its marginal employments. Again, I will repeat, the price of every factor of production in limited supply, and thus the price of all of its various products, is determined by the importance attached to the least important of the employments for which its supply suffices. That is, by the importance attached to its marginal employments. You can think, incidentally, of the concept of a marginal employment as being the least important among the most important employments. The marginal employment is the least important among the most important employments. In our example of wheat, for instance, the price of wheat in the present-day United States is determined by the importance attached to the use of wheat in feeding meat animals, its marginal employment in the context of our economy. This results from the fact that the price of wheat has to be low enough to permit its use to be profitable in all of its employments. If wheat is to be used in feeding meat animals, its price has to be low enough to make that use profitable at prices consumers are willing to pay for wheat-fed meat. However, there is only one uniform price of wheat in the same market at the same time. And as a result, the bread industry pays no more for wheat than the cattle raising industry. And because the price of bread is determined by its cost of production, the price of bread in the United States is actually determined not by its own potential importance, which may be as great as the stilling of hunger, but by the relatively low importance attaching to the use of wheat in producing meat. Or to take another example, the price of surgical instruments on which countless lives may depend is not determined by the importance of the needs they serve directly. It is not even determined by the importance attached to the marginal employments of iron and steel, but by the importance attached to the marginal employments of the ability groups of the labor that produces iron and steel and surgical instruments. Because the price of surgical instruments is determined by their cost of production, and the wage rates which constitute that cost are low enough to make the employment of the different ability groups of labor profitable in their marginal employments. To put it another way, the price even of surgical instruments is no higher in relation to the wages of the ability groups of labor employed to produce them than the marginal products of such labor, which may be a quantity of razor blades or even magazines or chocolate bars or who knows what. To summarize our discussion of factors of production in limited supply, we have seen that all the principles apply that we developed in relation to consumers' goods in limited supply, plus two others. First, that factors are distributed to their most important employments through a process of the different needs, desires, and purposes of the same individual consumers bidding against one another. And second, that the prices of the factors are determined with respect to the least important among the employments for which their supply suffices. Determination of price by cost, we have seen, therefore, ultimately means determination with respect to the consumer's value judgments concerning the marginal products of factors of production. This insight, incidentally, is one of the great contributions of Böhm-Bawerk, this whole analysis of the relation of costs, prices, and Marginal Products is the work of Bohm-Bawerk. Now, before we take a break, I must go back to the earlier part of this evening's lecture, of this evening's discussion for a moment. I must point out that, in fact, the price of virtually everything in limited supply, individual consumers' goods as well as factors of production, is determined with respect to its marginal importance to consumers. For example, the price of rental space must be low enough to find customers for all of the space, which means, in most cases, to find customers for extra bedrooms, garages, larger sized rooms, and so forth. And since space of the same quality has the same rent in the same market, the whole supply rents at a price conformable to the importance of the marginal quantity. Similarly, the price of the rare wine must probably be low enough to permit some people to buy second or third bottles, and so on. And therefore, it too must conform to the importance attached to a marginal quantity. Thus, we can reformulate our principle of price determination and say that the prices of goods and services in limited supply are determined not simply by the value judgments of consumers, but by their value judgments with respect to marginal quantities of those goods or services. On the basis of what we have learned about how a free market channels factors of production in limited supply into their most important employments, I am going to explain more fully than was possible before two important characteristics of a free market that we have already observed in previous lectures. Let us consider first the amazing adaptability and efficiency of a free market in responding to changes in economic conditions. We already know from Lecture 3 how changes in consumer demand cause changes in capital investment. We also know that changes in capital investment cause changes in the demand for factors of production, and that these demand changes cause movements in the supply of factors of production. For example, if more capital is invested in the auto industry and less in some other industry, the auto industry makes a larger demand for factors of production and the other industry a smaller demand. And as a result, the auto industry is able to buy a larger quantity of factors of production, while the other industry must buy a smaller quantity. But there is more to say on the basis of what we have learned tonight. Namely, we will see how every change in the demand or supply of a factor of production in a free market is dealt with in the most rational and efficient manner possible. That is, in a way that maximizes gains and minimizes losses. Let us start with the simplest case, which will serve as a preparation for the more complicated cases I want to focus on. Let us consider two products made by essentially the same mix of labor from the same materials, say washing machines and refrigerators. Both of these probably require just about the same overall proportions of skilled and unskilled labor in their production, use largely the same materials, and can probably be produced in the same factories without difficulty or without great difficulty of converting facilities. As a result, if the demand for one of them increases while the demand for the other decreases, there will probably be little or no change at all in the demand for factors of production that cannot be matched by an immediate corresponding shift in the supply of factors of production. Essentially, all that occurs in this case is that more of the same kind of factors of production are employed in one capacity, less in another. the production of one item is expanded in accordance with a change in consumer demand, and the production of another item is contracted. In this case, there is obviously no tendency toward a change in the prices of the factors of production. But now let us consider a more complicated case, which will bring out the particular principles I want to develop. Assume that a change in fashion occurs, which dictates that the average person own one extra wristwatch, and which at the same time encourages him to own one less suit or dress. Now, the labor used to produce clothes cannot be transferred to the production of watches because of the enormous skill differences involved. Here, therefore, we have a case of changes in the demand for factors of production that cannot be matched by offsetting shifts in the supply of factors of production. Let us see what happens in such a case in a free market. The wage rate of watchmakers and the cost of production and price of watches, of course, will rise, while the wage rates of garment workers and the cost of production and price of clothing will fall. However, the effects will not be confined to these initial areas of impact. A rise in the wages of watchmakers will begin to attract other workers into the field, say some workers who would have gone into instrument making, optics, jewelry making, and so forth. That is, whatever fields employ labor of a kind that can be used to make watches. A fall in the wage rates of garment workers, on the other hand, will begin to push some of these workers out of that field and into other fields. As a result, a tendency develops toward widening and diffusing the initial impact of the change in demand. As workers leave fields such as instrument making and optics to go into watchmaking, the wage rates and thus the production costs and product prices in these fields will begin to rise. Observe, the rise in demand for watches will raise not only the cost and price of watches, but also the cost and price of instruments, optical goods, and so forth, all products that use the same kind of labor as watchmaking. Conversely, as workers leave the garment industry and begin to enter other fields for which they possess the necessary skills, the wage rates, production costs, and product prices in those fields will begin to decline. Please keep these facts in mind, namely, that a rise in the demand for watches raises the price of all other goods whose production uses the same kind of labor as watches, and that a fall in the demand for clothing reduces the price of all other goods whose production uses the same kind of labor as clothing. Now, the question we want to ask is, what principle determines which industries, among those that employ the same kind of labor as watchmaking, actually release additional labor for watchmaking, and to what extent? And which industries among those potentially capable of absorbing the labor released from the garment industry actually absorb it, and to what extent? To arrive at the answer, we must realize that at the higher prices of the various goods that use the same kind of labor as watches, the consumers will reduce their purchases of those goods. It is these decisions of the consumers to restrict their purchases that determine which of the industries release labor for watchmaking and to what extent. For example, if the consumers decide to go on buying an unchanged quantity of optical goods at their higher price, but a reduced quantity of jewelry and various instruments, none of the labor will come from the optical goods industry, and all of it will come from the jewelry and instrument industries. Obviously, the labor will come from these various industries in accordance with whatever proportions the consumers decide to curtail their purchases of the various products at their respectively higher prices. Clearly, what occurs in this case is a kind of indirect bidding for labor between the buyers of wristwatches and the buyers of all other products employing the same kind of labor. The buyers of wristwatches, in effect, bid up the price of the wider category of labor that produces both wristwatches and all the other products that I have mentioned. In the face of this intensified bidding, the buyers of these other products, jewelry, instruments, optical goods, and so forth, must either match the bids of the watch buyers or restrict their purchases. To the degree that they restrict their purchases, they release labor to the watch industry and make possible its expansion. Now, to the extent that the consumers are rational, the products whose purchase they discontinue at the higher prices will be the least important among the ones they previously purchased. That is, the consumers will discontinue their previously marginal purchases. Because each consumer who buys these various products, instruments, jewelry, optical goods, and so on, will cut back his purchases in the way that hurts him least in his context and in his judgment. Thus, if he needs eyeglasses, he will certainly go on buying a pair of eyeglasses, but perhaps forego the purchase of a telescope for his hobby, say. If he was previously in a position to buy several pairs of eyeglasses and a telescope and some jewelry, then when he is confronted with higher prices for all of them, he may decide to go ahead with the telescope but cut back on an extra pair of sunglasses and some jewelry. The effect on the quantities demanded of these goods in the whole economy is, of course, simply the aggregate of all such individual decisions. In this way, we can see that in a free economy, the labor released for watchmaking will come from its previously marginal employments. That is, from the employments where all the various individual consumers in the market judge they can best spare it. Now, by the same token, the labor released from the garment industry will be absorbed in those employments that are the most important of the employments for which that type of labor was previously insufficient. That is, it will be absorbed in the most important of its previously submarginal employments. This conclusion follows from the fact that the workers released will be seeking to earn the highest incomes they can, and that these incomes will be found in producing those goods for which the consumers are willing to allow the highest prices over and above the allowance for the other costs entailed in producing them. I have not attempted to enumerate these other employments because the skills involved are so common that the labor released would probably be absorbed to some degree in a vast number of industries. For example, some of the former garment workers might end up as office workers, taxi drivers, metal workers, or who knows what. They will go to the most important of the employments for which there was previously inadequate labor. Now, everything we have said about the source of labor for additional watches applies in principle to the source of any factor of production in limited supply for an expansion of the production of any good. Always, the process is essentially one of an intensified bidding for the factor by the consumers of one or more of its particular products against the consumers of its other products. The bidding drives up the price of the factor, the costs of using it in production, and the prices of all of its various products. Supplies of the factor are always released in accordance with the choices of the consumers from the production of its previously marginal products. That is, from the products where the consumers decide they can best spare it. And in the same way, everything we have said about the absorption of labor released from the garment industry applies to the absorption of any factor in limited supply released from any industry. Always, the factor is absorbed in the most important of its employments previously unprovided for, in accordance with the judgment of the consumers, as manifested in what they are willing to pay the most for. The identical reasoning that we have applied to changes in the demand for a factor of production in limited supply applies to changes in the supply of such a factor. If the overall supply of a factor should increase, the addition goes to provide for the most important of the employments of the factor previously unprovided for. For example, an increase in the supply of wheat in the present-day United States would be used to expand the production of such things as wheat-fed meat and aged whiskey. If the supply of a factor should decrease, the reduction is taken out on the least important of the employments previously provided for. In the context of the present-day United States, this would mean a reduction in the production of such things as wheat-fed meat and aged whiskey. In other words, an increase in the supply of a factor goes to the most important of the previously submarginal employments. A decrease is taken out on the previously marginal employments. The principle that emerges from this discussion is that in a free market, changes in the demand or supply of any limited factor of production are dealt with in the most rational, efficient manner possible. This is because, as we have just seen, if a factor is in reduced demand or additional supply, the portion of it that becomes newly available is channeled to the most important of the previously submarginal employments of the factor. By the same token, if the factor is in additional demand or reduced supply, the portion of it that is no longer available is taken from the least important of its previous employments. That is, from its previously marginal employments. I will repeat this. If a factor is in reduced demand or additional supply, the portion of it that becomes newly available is channeled to the most important of the previously submarginal employments of the factor. By the same token, if the factor is in additional demand or reduced supply, the portion of it that is no longer available is taken from the least important of its previous employments, that is, from its previously marginal employments. In other words, every change in the demand or supply of any factor of production in a free market is dealt with in a way that maximizes gains and minimizes losses. This rationality and efficiency in responding to changes in economic conditions is the first characteristic of a free market that I wanted to bring out more fully. This characteristic has major application to the Arab oil embargo. It enables us to understand in yet another respect how a free market would have minimized the impact of any reduction in the supply of oil that the Arabs might have been able to impose on us. If we had had a free market, the price of crude oil and the production costs and prices of all oil products would have risen during the embargo. The consumers would have decided where the reduction in the use of crude oil was to be effected and to what degree by the extent to which they cut back on their purchases of the various oil products at the higher prices. Where the use of an oil product was important, consumers would have paid the higher price, and oil would have continued to be used for this purpose. Only where the use of an oil product was not worth its higher price would the use of oil have been cut back or discontinued. For example, consumers would have paid a higher price for the gasoline required to drive to work and for the heating oil required to keep them warm. They would not have been as ready to pay higher prices for the gasoline required for extra shopping trips or for heating oil to keep their garages warm.